ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Our discussion about the importance of independent but supported long-term accommodation for people with serious mental illness. Look, the experience of providing residences which integrate social housing with support to provide long-term and individualised homes has enabled residents to thrive in Australia and overseas. I mean, it works. We know it works. Why aren't we doing it more? Joining us tonight, we have Professor Olive Nielsen. Olive is a psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at Macquarie University, also worked for 15 years in prisons and 17 years in the homelessness sector, notably at the clinic at the Matthew Talbot Hostel, and he's behind the Habilis housing project about to open in Summer Hill. Olive, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife. It's very, very good to have you. We're even better, I suppose, the paternity microphone on. There you go. Thanks, Olive. Also joining us too, Professor Alan Fells, the former chairman of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Alan, terrific to have your time as well.
Thank you very much,
Philip. Alan worked to establish The Haven in 2011, then becoming chair of the Mind Australia Board. Also joining us from Brescia in Italy, we have the Professor of Psychiatry at the Catholic University in Milan, and he's also Head of Clinical Research in Brescia. Giovanni Di Girolamo is the Head of Clinical Research, as I said, at Brescia, and for the past 3 decades has been involved in and has researched the issues of homelessness and the mentally ill. Giovanni, good evening to you, and welcome to Nightlife as well.
Thank you. Here it's 1 o'clock. It's not evening, but it's fine.
In the Nightlife program with the Nightlife family, Giovanni, we are all together at all times of the day in all parts of the world. So welcome aboard.
Okay.
Look, Olive, first up to you. You're about to open a new residential housing project, Habilis Housing in Summerhill in Sydney, which will get to in a moment. But let's start with the basics, can we? You've worked with homelessness and mentally ill people for many years. Indeed, I believe you grew up with a boarding house in your own street. You became a nurse in Roselle, a psychiatric hospital as a young man before going on to study medicine, became a psychiatrist, and you work in prisons in the Matthew Talbot Hospital. So you've had a fair bit of experience in this. What is schizophrenia anyway, and why is it so disabling, and why is housing such an issue?
Well, we could spend all night on what schizophrenia. But look, at its heart, it's a neurodegenerative condition affecting the frontal lobes or the decision-making parts of the brain. So the reason it's disabling is the sort of loss of ability to make good decisions and to plan and organise life, basically. I mean, you hear a lot about hallucinations and delusional ideas and so on, but the disabling element of schizophrenia is in, you know, day-to-day decision-making.
Mm. People are afraid of it, aren't they? This is part of the problem. That is, people have no familiarity with it. You use a word like this and people immediately put up barriers, don't they?
Well, I mean, there's a stigma associated with it, and associated part of the disability is in social interaction. So, of course, people seem strange or different, or, you know, they don't look after themselves overly well. Mm. With severe forms, I should say, it's there's a great variety of severity and cause of the illness. So we're just talking about, you know, the most severely ill and severely disabled.
I mean, the answer probably suggests itself as to why those who are living with schizophrenia find it hard to get accommodation. Tell me about why in particular.
Well, we could start with poverty, because if you haven't got the wherewithal to hold down a job or find a job and so on, you're immediately, you know, dependent on social welfare, and then again, the social skills required to, you know, join the queue at an open house for example, to lease a property. I mean, the skills needed to keep a place clean and pay all the bills and, you know, stop squatters from coming and staying. And these are the kinds of disabling characteristics of schizophrenia.
Mm. Yeah, you've worked in prisons. You've described prisons as modern-day asylums. Tell me about that.
Well, they are in New South Wales, at least, our oldest industry, of course, but they've sort of 7 to 10% of our prisoners, so it's about I don't know, 10% of 12,000 people, 1,200. But so it's the biggest hospital system in the state is in the prisons. And it's...
is little understood. I mean, I know it's understood by people who are working it, but it's little understood outside of that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, again, the kind of
prisons are full of wrongdoers, and that's true, but the reasons for their wrongdoing are often way more complicated than people think.
Exactly right. I mean, there are all sorts of psychosocial disabilities will cause you to, break laws or lack the forethought to, and of course, comorbid addiction is the sort of the common factor.
Mm.
But look, it's the same kind of poor decisions that, you know, make you homeless are also the sort of poor decisions that'll get you in front of the courts and into jail.
Mm. You describe housing as the first principle of providing solutions for the mentally ill, for the homeless. Because if you haven't got somewhere stable to live, then you can't make any progress in any aspect of your life, can you?
Yeah, well, no, exactly right. I mean, some people think it's a choice to sleep in the open, but it really is, I've got to tell you. It's a terribly insecure and, often frightening lifestyle. And also it's very hard to provide treatment to someone if they haven't got an address. And it's consistency of treatment is what, you know, keeps people with schizophrenia out of hospital and out of jail too, probably.
Mm. Yeah, this is another aspect of homelessness which I think is not well understood, is it? That homelessness is some kind of choice that people make. It's that it's just the fact that people won't go to the accommodation that they should have.
Yeah, well, they don't keep it, I think, is the big
thing.
What I've noticed. You know, like, for example, the housing department's been very good to us, and I'm talking about the people that come to the Matthew Talbot Hostel Clinic. Mm. You know, mm. they often get a priority housing flat fairly soon, but they don't keep it because other people move in. The door comes off, there's sort of squalor and housing, our public housing estates are sort of a little bit predatory sometimes, you know. So, in large complexes, you get picked on a bit. It's not sustainable without supports.
Mm. Because that's the thing. We're talking about accommodation here, but it's not just building flats, isn't it? And then saying, well, here's a key, that's where you live now, you'll be all right now. I mean, the doctor knows where you are and everything will be fine. It's not just the housing, is it?
No, I think it's a type of housing, and you probably hear more from Haven because they've really got the runs on the board as far as, working out what the physical surround should look like. And also from, Giovanni's experience in Italy, they've built, 30,000 beds in Italy.
Yeah, we're going to go there in a moment. Look, you mentioned the Haven. Joining us also tonight is Mark Heaney. Now, Mark is the Executive Director of Housing Strategy at Mind Australia, and they run the Haven Foundation in Melbourne and across regional Victoria. The Haven Foundation is Australia's largest specialist community housing provider for people living with serious mental illness. They're also expanding into New South Wales and the ACT. Mark, good evening to you. Tell us about the Haven, its history and what it is now and what it does.
Hi, Phil. Good to be here. So the Haven Foundation, it's a specialist community housing provider specifically for people with mental illness. We currently have 178 homes across 11 locations with a further 164 that are soon to be built, ranging across Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia. What makes the Haven, I guess, very unique is that people have access to round-the-clock support by specialist mental health support workers. So people have the privacy of their own home. They have access to everything that everyone else should have within their own home, but they have that assurance of staff on site with them as well who can help them out whenever they need that help all throughout the evening as well.
How does that work? I mean, we're told that, particularly in mental health, there are shortages everywhere of trained people. How does this work? I mean, the idea of having it on tap, as it were.
So the Haven Foundation's parent company is Mind Australia, and Mind Australia have been around for around 45 years. They've got a really strong reputation, and that funding comes from the NDIS. So people that live within a Haven residence are recipients of NDIS funding. they pull their money together, their NDIS funds, and then they pay for support workers to be able to be there to provide them some one-to-one mental health support as well as that shared overnight support as well.
Mm. So without the NDIS, is it fair to say this couldn't have happened?
Look, without the NDIS, it would just be social housing on its own. And to Olav's point earlier, without that necessary support, often tenancies do not continue because people might run into issues where they might become unwell, they may stop paying their rent, they may have issues with their neighbours. But with that support present all the time, the trained staff are able to intervene really quickly. They get to know the residents that are living there really well. They get to understand what their triggers are, their early warning signs are, and they can put measures in place to be able to ensure that person can stay well, stay out of hospital, and to keep their tenancy.
Mm. Let's bring in Alan Fells here. Professor Fells, of course, former chairman of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. His eldest daughter, Isabella, was diagnosed with schizophrenia in her 20s. Alan worked to establish the Haven in 2011 with 14 one-bedroom units. Tell me, Alan, what your experience of this was through your daughter's, or through your eyes, watching your daughter.
Well, she had a permanent condition. She required help all the time, almost, mm-hmm. or at unpredictable times of day and night. She needed some stable, secure accommodation long term. It's quite difficult when she lives at home. Also, her parents aren't around forever, so we wanted to take a long term view and to have some on site staff. It's worked out incredibly well. It's hugely reduced her visits to hospital. She lives in independent apartments. She doesn't have to have anything to do with anyone else, but there are 13 others. And as a matter of fact, they make up a fine community. They get on well with one another. They're close to shopping and housing and mental health services. So it's really transformed her life.
That's right. You became Mind Australia board chair. Tell me about the funding of and how that works.
Well, you have to get a building in the first place and some land. And it is quite difficult to get from governments because they're not spending that much on housing. And then within that, they're not spending that much on social housing. And then if you want to say mental health housing is a special case, it's really hard to get money. However, we have been quite successful in Victoria. Victoria recognised that there are special characteristics of mental health housing and they allocated some of their social housing money to it. So that's one bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second bit, as you've heard, on-site staff are met because all the residents have got really serious mental illness and so they qualify for disability support from the NDIS, that gives us on-site staff. And then as to their living costs, they basically get the disability support pension, maybe with Commonwealth Rent Assistance, and they have to pay a bit of that to us as rent to keep the building going and pay off certain debts in buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it they spend on their own living costs. That's the financial system in short.
Okay, so it's sustaining though, is it? I mean, you can keep this going, can you?
Well, it's been going well with the NDIS. Right now, there's a review of everything in the NDIS,
mm-hmm.
and actually we have some apprehensions about it. Less so for the established havens, but maybe when we start doing more and filling the other 170-odd that was just mentioned by Mark, we may run into problems. We put them to Minister Shorten to various other people. We wait and see.
Mm. How, Mark, tell me about how big you think the need is.
I feel the need is huge. So we announce probably around 6 months out before we open a haven. Mm-hmm. A lot of our havens are within regional Victoria, and we have wait lists that build up very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that we can't meet the needs of everybody, but we know the wait times on public housing wait lists are still growing, particularly in New South Wales.
So well, I think in New South Wales they're in excess of 6-7 years, aren't they?
That's right. And often people with significant mental illness, because of often how their mental illness plays out, that can often make it a lot harder and less likely for people to get access to other forms of social housing. So I think that the need is growing, and we just really need to ensure, as Alan mentioned, that the NDIS continues to keep funding the support into a haven, because the evidence that we are seeing is pretty incredible. We have La Trobe University are in the midst of a 5-year evaluation, and one of the findings that they have found is that 12 months after somebody living within a haven, the reduction in hospitalisation has gone down by 86%. Mm. So it's a huge saving for the state government through the public health system. It is taking the pressure off much needed hospital beds and ensuring people can stay well and stay safe within their community.
Yeah, because this is the point, isn't it, Olive, that someone said once that health systems are only interested in four things. The number one and the number one thing on the list is cost. That is what things cost. But this is cheaper to do. It's more effective, but it's also cheaper to look after people in this way, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got a study of linking the health usage, criminal justice, and other service use of our homeless cohort from the Matthew Talbot Clinic, and they've racked up $540 million, $500 million in hospital costs alone in a period of about 8 years, and we've calculated that we'd save $4.40 for every dollar spent on the housing, on the capital costs, and I think that's an underestimate after seeing the figures that have been racked up. And that's just the financial. You forget about the moral issue of trying to look after people.
No. Of course, I mean that's an entirely other dimension. But I mean, I can understand people listening to this program and saying, "Well, yes. But how much is all this costing?" The answer is, it costs way less to do this than it does to say, do what the other is, which is in crisis, these people are going to have to be admitted to hospital.
No, exactly. Well, I mean, part of the problem always has been the people who fund it aren't the people who reap the benefits. Mm. So you keep people out of jail and you keep people out of hospital, and the cost is borne by the housing department.
Mm. Adam's just texted me saying, Phil, I've got schizophrenia. I was diagnosed in 1991. I was born this way. I'm proud to have made it into my 50s without ever getting into debt. A good decision. However, I'm renting. I've rented 28 different houses. That's the pinch point that stresses me out every day. Stable, affordable, and safe housing is imperative. I can't keep moving. I'm too sedated. Olive, you're shaking your head saying, yeah, exactly.
Exactly. No, it's housing is a treatment in and of itself, and I've just heard this over and again, you know, in the homeless clinic. I mean, every consultation is about housing, and even people in public housing don't sometimes feel secure if their neighbours are hostile, so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because exactly. Mark, this is the thing. As life goes on, these issues become more and more critical, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. I think that often as people age, having that stability of housing is really important. People can have other health issues that crop up as they age as well. So being able to maintain that independence and that stability within your community is absolutely integral for somebody's overall mental health and well-being.
Hmm. Alan, how do you see it from that longer term? I mean, just taking Adam's point about, you know, long term, I mean, he's in his 50s now, long term, getting some stable housing is getting harder, not easier.
Yes.
How do you see what you're doing as
well? I see it as important, and I just wanted to add to the conversation the fact that many, many people with severe mental illness live in housing. They're not homeless, but live in very poor, substandard housing. Some bits of the public housing system these days are not great. They're dangerous. They're unhappy environments and so on. There are rooming houses, special residential services and things like that. So there's a big population in there needing to be looked after. And as you say, it is ongoing. The illness is normally permanent or very long term. The needs increase as you get older and less able to look after yourself, and other physical ailments start to affect you. We are finding with our residents that as they age, some of the needs increase, and that adds to the challenges.
Adam, who sent me that text, has just given me a call too. G'day, Adam.
Good evening, Philip. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure. You'd just like to add something further. Go on.
Yeah, look, I have a personal belief, and it may be a schizophrenic kind of point of view, but I believe one of the biggest causes of homelessness in Australia is the banking sector. I am unable to borrow money from a bank because I'm unable to work. And if I could borrow money from a bank at a fixed interest rate, at a low interest rate fixed for the term of the loan, there may be a method there that could facilitate people like myself into home ownership. Another factor I've noticed about home is that if I want to move into social or affordable housing, I'm required to move out of my current rental. I'd like to see some sort of state-based subsidy so that they can subsidise my private rental to make it at an affordable price.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Adam. Olive?
Yeah, well,
what do you think about those ideas?
Well, firstly, I mean, I agree that it would be very nice to be able to live in a suburb of your choice and in an area of your choice where you grew up in and you've got all your connections. And so subsidising private rental like that is... there's a fair bit of it. I know that... in inner city Sydney, of course, the prices are sky high. In regional areas, you're more likely to get the normal housing.
Yeah, exactly. All right, look, we're going to talk in a moment to Giovanni Di Girolamo about what Italy did about this, because it's a very interesting development, and I'm interested to bring Giovanni into the conversation as well. In the meantime, let's just welcome some other listeners to the program.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
And if you are just joining us, this is Nightlife. We are talking about community housing for those with psychological disabilities and models which work. And, well, I think we'd all agree that the current models we have are woefully inadequate. But four fascinating guests on tonight who are talking about it, are acting out in actual solutions. We've been hearing from Professor Olive Nielsen, the psychiatrist, about the Habitless Housing Project, which is about to open in Summer Hill. Mark Heaney's with us from the Haven Foundation. That's providing safe and secure homes for people who've got psychosocial disabilities in Victoria in particular, and it's expanding elsewhere. Professor Alan Fells is with us, has also had personal experience of this through his eldest daughter, Isabella, diagnosed with schizophrenia. Alan's worked with The Haven and is also chair of Mind Australia. Let's introduce Giovanni Di Girolamo. Now, Giovanni is professor of psychiatry at the Catholic University of Milan and also head of a clinical research centre in Brescia in Italy. And for the past three decades or more, he's He's been providing, well, he's been researching the Italian experience of providing community-based residential facilities. This is in the decade since 1978, when Italian law basically blocked new admissions to public mental institutions. In other words, if you had a mental health issue, you couldn't get into a public mental hospital. Giovanni, tell me about how that happened and what the response was.
Okay. In brief, in the 70s, there was a large anti-institutional movement in Italy fighting for a more humane and effective mental health care. And the main objective of this large movement was to shut down the 80 mental hospitals which were in operation in those years.
Mm-hmm.
There were approximately 80,000 inmates in these 80 mental hospitals. And in 1978, this large movement, which was led by a well-known psychiatrist called Franco Basaglia, obtained a great victory because the Italian parliament voted a so-called reform law, which decided a few things like the progressive, not immediate, but progressive closing of these 80 mental hospitals, the establishment of 15 beds general hospital psychiatric wards in order to make mental health care, psychiatric care, equal to medical care, mm-hmm. as it should be, and the creation of a large network of community mental health centers.
Okay.
I should say that in the law which was approved in 1978, there was in fact a missing spot, which was where to host either patients discharged from mental hospitals and unable to live independently, or new patients who were unable to live independently because of their severe mental disorder.
Sure.
In a way, naturally, we had to set up non-hospital residential facilities. And so 20 years later, in 2000, when I was working at the Italian NIH, we decided that it was needed and it was timely to set up a large survey of these non-hospital residential facilities scattered across the country. And so we did this study funded by the Italian Ministry of Health, and we surveyed approximately 20,000 hosts of these residential facilities. We found that these facilities had an average of 12 residents. The very large majority, over 90% of these facilities, had a 24-hour cover. So there was a support by a nurse at any time. And of course, during the day, there were also doctors, a lot of psychosocial interventions, etc.
What about, tell me, Giovanni, how successful has it been? I mean, how would you rate its success? You've looked at this experiment and how it's gone. How do you think it's had? Has it succeeded or not?
Okay, we should be very careful about the term success. Residential facilities don't make miracles. Okay, they are just homes for life, as spelled out by a famous European psychiatrist, Julian Leff, who in fact named these residential facilities for many patients homes for life.
Hmm.
They don't make miracles because it's not that being in a residential facility automatically leads to recovery. I mean, it would be too easy. It would be like, imagine that being in a surgical room without making any surgery leads you to recovery. You need to be in a surgical room, but you also need to undergo surgery. And it's the same in a residential facility. It's a treatment setting for many patients. It's a lifelong setting, but does make miracles. But it can ensure the best possible quality of life to people having to face a severe mental
disorder. Right. And so I understand, Giovanni, that it's also the cost per bed, as it were, is significantly less than the hospital's cost. And absolutely. And the workforce absolutely. Deployed is significantly smaller. Is that correct?
It's absolutely true. When we did our national survey, which to date it's the largest survey of a nationwide system of residential facilities, we found we did a very careful economic evaluation. And we found that being for a patient requiring full-time treatment, we found that being in a residential facility is enormously cheaper than being in a large mental hospital with 1,000 beds. But besides the economic cost, I want to stress the issue of quality of life. And in particular, I want to stress that to live decently in a residential facility, it's imperative to keep it on a very small scale, because only being of a limited size, you can grant residents a domestic-like environment. That's the key of a residential facility. Being living in a domestic-like environment and not in a very odd mental hospital with hundreds of beds, etc. From this point of view, for instance, some residential facilities which are currently in operation, for instance, in the United States, hosting 80 or 100 people, are not residential facilities, because can you imagine a domestic-like environment with 100 people? It's not a domestic-like environment.
All right. We're talking with Professor Giovanni Di Girolamo, who's a professor of psychiatry at the Catholic University of Milan. Let's just go back to our other guest here, Giovanni, for a moment too. I mean, this is the key to it, is it, Mark? Mark Heaney is Executive Director of Housing Strategy with Mind Australia, which runs the Haven Foundation in Victoria and elsewhere. This is the key to it, is it, Mark? It's got to be small and it's got to be integrated into the rest of the community.
Yeah, that's right, Phil. So the Haven model has between 12 to 16 units.
Yeah.
And everyone has even their own outdoor area, so it's really important that people feel as though they have their own safe space that they can be able to be in. And within the community, we really ensure that when we choose a location, it is right next to public transport. It's very close to shops. It's very close to parks and also close to health services. These types of residences, they don't belong on hospital grounds, because they're not hospitals. They're people's homes. They need to be within the community.
Are you building these buildings or are you buying them?
So we buy the land and then we work with the state government. They will provide a one-off grant fund to us to then build them. And then we would work with local builders of that particular area to build them. And they generally take around 12 to 18 months to build.
Olive, tell me about your project in Summer Hill. Was it easy to get approval to build such a thing? Because after all, I'm thinking. I mean, a resident's going to be calm about the fact that they're going to have a community like that in their midst.
Well, firstly, it's on Parramatta Road. We've had no complaints from residents, actually. We've got a little residential enclave behind us, but no, they've been very calm about it. But the planning system's definitely broken, and I know Alan's, Phil's has actually even influenced changes to the planning system in Victoria, but no, the red tape was an absolute nightmare. I think there are some precedents that that councils will need to sort of accept this kind of housing and try and, you know, assist the, because it's been an absolute nightmare.
Tell me about a bit more about the workforce here, Mark, and Olive too. I mean, we're constantly being told about shortages of mental health professionals and mental health workers everywhere, and you know, why does this address that? Is this a more efficient deployment of mental health workers? Do you need fewer of them? I mean, why is it better?
I don't. If you're, I'll turn to Mark in a moment. But our model's a little bit different to Haven's. Haven One in South Yarra was just for schizophrenia, but they've expanded to all sorts of psychosocial disabilities, so I understand it. We're just focusing on people with schizophrenia, so we've got a medically led. So we've got a clinic on site. The scale's a little bit larger, and our justification for that is that the disability of schizophrenia is loss of volition, and I'm really, from experience, it'll be fairly quiet. It doesn't need the kind of staffing levels that perhaps Haven has been used to, with, you know, several overnight staff. We've got a caretaker. We've got day staff to help planning and organising things. But the key thing is we've got a clinic on site. So we've got a visiting psychiatrist, a visiting mental health nurse, and the key thing is ensuring continuity of treatment. So it's not really that labour intensive, especially when people are well and are pretty organised in their routines. We're expecting to operate it in a very efficient way.
I don't look, Olive, you might be the best person to address this question, which have come in from a number of listeners saying, what's been the wash up of the so-called Richmond? Well, not the so-called. What was the wash up of the Richmond report? I mean, the Richmond report was a major report into the way we deal with mentally ill people in our community, and advocated the closing of hospitals and care in the community. The trouble is, it didn't seem to happen, and there was something of a crisis in housing for mentally ill across Australia, which tonight we're talking about solutions. But in essence, solutions that should have come off the back of the Richmond Report, shouldn't they?
Exactly. You know, the Richmond Report came out in 1982, and by that time, deinstitutionalisation had already occurred.
As Giovanni's talking about, I mean, it's not just in Australia, it became a worldwide thing, didn't it?
Italy did the Richmond Report. And Alan Fels and Mind and Habilis are hoping to do the Richmond Report 40 years too late, basically. Yeah.
That's it, is it?
Yeah. Well, exactly what David Richmond recommended, which is small facilities in the community, sort of small units, mental health units in teaching hospitals, which we've got. We've got the wards, but they're very stressed because there's nowhere to house people and nowhere where people will be guaranteed to get
treatment. Alan, why didn't we do it? You've dealt with big policy in your life. What happened as a result of the Richmond Report? Well, why didn't we get on with it? You still with us, Alan?
In the ideology of cutting back on government, government spending and so on, a lot of the Richmond report and similar reports was converted into an excuse for cutting back spending. Matched by that, there was a failure to recognise that these people coming out of asylums and so on needed, above all, accommodation that was never recognised or funded. And the almost glorious picture painted in these reform reports like Richmond of a better future for mentally ill was just not delivered because of a lack of willingness to spend. By the way, on top of that, the mental health system is not terribly well organised. It's broken up into different bits that don't actually get coordinated very well.
Tell me about that,
Well, for example, housing, say you're in a hospital and you come out and you need accommodation, often there's no accommodation for you. And then maybe you instruct hospitals, you've got to be sure there's accommodation for people, and some arrange it, but others arrange a few weeks of accommodation in a motel, and that's the end of it. So there's no deep integration for people coming out of the housing system, out of the hospital system, into housing.
Mark, who's in charge of it all, as it were? I mean, I understand, you know, from the point of view, a small local project, how that can work, but is anybody looking over this sector and looking at what you're doing and thinking, yes, this is what we should be doing?
Look, I think what makes it really complex is that all states and territories are doing things very differently.
Yeah.
And that makes it very confusing for people who really need that support as well. So when you access a mental health service within New South Wales versus Victoria, your experience is going to be very, very different because the funding setup is very complex in both those areas as well. I think what can really be helpful is this significant injection into social housing that the Commonwealth are doing, and that's called the Housing Australia Future Fund. We haven't seen any announcements around there being specific housing for people with serious mental illness, but the 30,000 new homes that are going to be funded over the next number of years, we're really calling on the Commonwealth to ensure that they are dedicating some of those homes to people with mental illness, because we know models like Haven and Habilis, they work. They keep people out of hospital. Haven's model is very focused on recovery. We focus on people's strengths and we ensure that they can work on building their relationships and building their capacity to be able to be active members within their community.
Yeah. I mean, as Professor Girolamo was saying, I mean, we don't want to get hung up on cures because this doesn't necessarily cure anybody, but it does provide them with dignity and a way to live, which they didn't have before.
That's right. And it's really that stable housing. It's good healthcare. As soon as somebody has access to that stability and that privacy, it just creates a huge leaps for somebody's mental health recovery to start forming those relationships again and building up that confidence to be able to get back into work and to be able to work on other areas of
in
their life.
In terms of workforce, Mark, you say at The Haven, it's not like the Summer Hill project that Olive's involved in, because Olive's talking about an on-site clinic that's attached to these residential units. That's not your model, is it?
No, our models are quite different in that manner, where we have what's called community mental health practitioners as well as peer practitioners. So a peer practitioner is somebody who's had their own experience of mental illness. Then they've then done training, typically a Certificate 4 in community services, to then learn how to work with other people with the mental illness as well. So we don't have clinical staff on site. We will take people into the community to their local health service to access those services. But our staff are generally trained in what's called recovery-oriented practices. So areas that really focus on building strengths, person-centred approaches to help people to work on and achieve their goals.
Alan, is there a need to address some of the issues that were raised by our caller, Adam, before about providing some more stable long-term access to housing finance that might enable more people to get? Because I'm thinking as we're talking tonight, I bet you there's a whole lot of people who can't get access to, you know, The Haven or the one that Olive's talking about. You know, the unmet need is huge. Is what Adam's talking about in terms of providing just some long-term stability of saying, look, here's a house, this is the housing loan, this is the interest rate, and this is what it's going to be for 20 years.
Yeah. On the whole, being a bit of a skeptic about banks, I'm not hopeful they'll come up with a solution, even a legislated one. But I do think in the field of housing development that there should always be provision if there's housing developments and businesses making a lot of money from it, that they should provide some social housing as part of the deal. I also agree with him. There is a case for supplementing the incomes of people who have to pay rents and who have serious mental illness and otherwise low income. And the government itself needs to get a lot more buildings going. As to the operating costs, well, we've been fortunate thus far. The NDIS does it. And as was sort of partly picked up by Olav and Mark, the NDIS funding is much better than much mental health funding, but it is for the disability part of the problem, not the mental health part of it.
Mm.
The NDIS doesn't deal with health costs, just your poor functioning in life as a result of some medical problem.
Mm. Yep. Olive, it gets back to, and Mark, you know, jump in on this comment as well. I mean, it just gets back to this issue, which we come to time and time again, that the government needs to pull its finger out in terms of its involvement in social housing, doesn't it? It talks about it. I mean, I know it's not doing it, but it needs to get involved in it in a much bigger way, doesn't it, Olive?
Well, you know,
I mean, you can't. I mean, you're not going to be able to build the Summerhill thing 100 times over.
Well, we're a charity. Exactly. We've had a philanthropic boost, and we had money from the state government of New South Wales. So. So they realise the there's a benefit from it. I think when you look at especially when the La Trobe assessment comes out and you can see how much money is being saved, they will say, "Well, this is place we must invest in." So I think the money will flow. But again, the organisations like Haven and Mind have just been incredible. The way they've just gone from, you know, one in 2011 to nearly 30 in the drawing board.
Is any state doing it better than anybody else, Mark, do you think?
We've been fortunate in Victoria. There was the Royal Commission into Mental Health Services in Victoria, which triggered that massive investment that we've seen. The Labor government in New South Wales have made an election commitment, very small, only three havens, only one in South Australia, and we're still working with the other states and territories to start investing.
Okay.
But I think the Commonwealth, through that Housing Australia Future Fund, there's a big responsibility here from the Commonwealth government to really start thinking about how they should be investing in this space.
Indeed. Look, it's a positive story. This is what we're talking about here tonight. It's a positive story. This stuff works. And we ought to be doing more of it. I really thank you for your time. Joining us tonight, Professor Olive Nielsen, a psychiatrist. Olive, good to have your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Heaney from the Haven Foundation. Mark, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Phil.
Professor Alan Fells, former chairman of the ACCC, of course, and chairman of Mind Australia. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
And Giovanni Di Girolamo, too, from Brescia, professor of psychiatry there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who texted in as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.